from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenkopf, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, hi, everybody. It's Steve Hayward back for another episode of the Powerline Show. And today, we're going to talk about cephalology. At least, I think maybe that's how that crazy Greek word that I can't even spell is pronounced. Cephalology is the art of the entrail reading that people do about elections and demographics and so forth. The best known name in this field is probably Nate Silver, although he's been downgraded to Nate Bronze since his catastrophic call in the 2016 election. You know, he made his bones years ago predicting a couple of elections exactly right on, as well as being a real maven for sports. But on election night in 2016, he was still saying, at 8 o'clock Eastern time that Hillary had an 80% chance of winning the presidency. And so he doesn't look very good these days. It was quite a debacle for him. My go-to cephalologist is joining us today on the Powerline Show. It's Henry Olson, the senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, contributor to the American Greatness, our friends that we talked to the other day. He's also, if I read this right somewhere, the flyover country editor at unheard.com. And I've not heard of Unheard much. I also think he's right now eating a secret brand of Wheaties, or maybe he maybe he does Tide Pods. I'm not sure, because he's just everywhere all the time. And we'll talk about his Reagan book here a little bit later in the broadcast. But good morning, Henry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, at least this version of me. The clones are calling in trying to coordinate.
I'll bet. So, look, I want to start with the most important question on the minds of Americans right now. Who's going to win the Super Bowl this week?
Tom Brady, New England Patriots. Excellence rewarded, and then he gets to go off as a winner.
Oh, you think he's going to retire after this, maybe?
Well, he's 40. No. He'll have 6 Super Bowl titles. Why not go out on top? I mean, it's going to be really hard for any quarterback to break the records in the playoffs that he's established if he can go out on top today.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's what, what's his name? John Elway did that after winning his second Super Bowl in a row, right? As he said, and also a Peyton Manning here recently. So interesting thought. I want to begin by going back to the last time we spoke together on a podcast, which was the summer of 2016. And at that time, you thought, as I thought and most people thought, that Donald Trump was a certain loser in November. But then you changed your mind, in fact, issuing your election night, election eve forecast. And I should add that you nailed the 2008 and 2012 elections exactly right, you know, where and how and who and so forth. Mm-hmm. The night before the election, you issued your forecasts in great detail, saying right now the odds favor a narrow Trump win. How did you change your mind? What did you see?
Oh, gosh. You know, between that time, I'd say there were 4 things that I saw. One was that Hillary was not taking advantage of the openings that Trump was giving her, that by mid-September, it was clear that she was not making the sale to the undecided non-democratic voter, which was giving him an opening to get back in the game. Second, what I noticed was after the Access Hollywood tapes, you would remember that Trump was closing the gap in all of the polls, and then he started to fall back, and then he closed the gap, and then he fell back. What I started to notice was that all the changes in the margin came from Trump support. It wasn't Hillary went up and Trump went down. It was Hillary was staying level and Trump was going up and down. And that was telling me this is soft Republican support trying to figure out where to go. And if she can't take advantage of the Access Hollywood tape, she's in real trouble. Third thing I saw was the polls that showed that 18% of Americans didn't like both candidates and that they were going to decide the election. And that as of late October, they still hadn't decided, but they were disproportionately Republican-leaning men. And I listened to Hillary's debates, and there was nothing she was saying that would say to a Republican-leaning college-educated male, take a chance on me. And then the fourth thing was that by the weekend before the election, you know, just by having experience as opposed to running regression analysis, which is what that Mr. Bronze does, is that people will believe they are going to throw their vote away until the moment they actually have to do it. And this is a well-observed phenomena going back at least to Al Gore. And I said in my analysis, 40% of these people won't do it. you know this from history, and 75% of them will go back to the party. And when I did my number analysis on that assumption, I said, holy bleep, the whole world is going to be surprised. And that's what happened.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry for the long answer, but it really was that series of things that got me to the point where my mind had completely changed.
No, that wasn't too long an answer at all. And it's, you know, more cogent than the explanations you're hearing from, you know, well, of course, it's racism, right? I mean, slogans from the left. But I am puzzled by one thing. I think you've noticed, you're not the only one, but you've made a big point in detail because you point to the places as you always do, where Trump performed poorly in some Republican areas. He lost Orange County. You know, he lost some of the typical Republican collar counties around Dallas, you've mentioned. And So that suggests to me that a lot of them didn't. Is that just Republican women? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, so there was a group of voters that Hillary did make the sale with. The thing is, they were baked into the cake relatively early. What she wasn't doing was making the sale with the people who weren't so repulsed by Trump by July that they had already made up their decision. These people are disproportionately the least conservative part of the Romney coalition. There's data from that, from the voter study group, that on issue after issue, the people who were Romney-Clinton voters were more highly educated, more affluent, and closer to the Democrats, although by no means Democratic partisans, than they were to any other segment of the Trump voting group. And they were particularly closer to the Democrats on cultural issues such as the role of religion in politics, immigration, and openness to different cultures. So pretty much anywhere you see those people, and it's true in Atlanta, it's even true in places like suburban Indianapolis, suburban Oklahoma City, almost every major metropolitan area in the country, with very few exceptions. And I've actually looked at every major metro to come up with that assessment, saw a movement away from Trump among these voters. And the problem for Clinton was most of those people lived in states that were already decided. And she didn't win a big enough margin among them. And this gets to the question of the more conservative of the people, you know, not the moderate Romney voters, but the more, you know, semi-conservative voters, they end up holding up their nose and voting for Trump. And she didn't make the sale farther down the ideological line.
Now, doesn't that suggest to me that Republicans have a breathtaking opportunity? I mean, if maybe Trump is Trump forever and it won't change, but if the Republican Party could keep a lot of the new independent voters and some of the Reagan Democrats that he's brought back and get back a lot of those suburban moderate voters, doesn't that suggest a recipe for a majority down the road?
Yep. That's exactly what it does, that the Republicans, for the first time in 85 years, or really for the first time since the end of the Reagan administration, have an opportunity to become the majority party. I wrote a piece for American Greatness recently that called Making the GOP Great Again, where based off of a simple chart that since 1931, every single year, more Americans say they are Democrat than Republican. The only time that gap closed significantly was during the Gippers administration. And guess what? That was the last time you saw a Republican intentionally try and combine blue collar and suburban voters who were not hardline conservatives in the same party. What do you know?
Right. Well, I want to come back to that Reagan question more precisely in a little bit, but I want to stick for a minute. Maybe I don't remember this correctly, but I thought I saw a piece of you from you right after the election saying, gosh, this could be the last gasp of a Republican party because a lot of those white working class voters that Trump attracted, among other things, are getting old. Right. And we do know about Trump and Republican brand, so to speak, generally is faring terribly with millennials, which are about to be or already the largest voting cohort, right? Would you change?
Well, in terms of potential numbers, but not in terms of actual voters, but yes.
Right. Well, did you change your mind a little bit, or how does your thinking evolve on this point that you're now somewhat optimistic?
Actually, I think both are true, and I haven't changed my mind on this particular point, which is there's a golden opportunity, but the window doesn't stay open long. The Democrats are right about one thing in their analysis of the electorate. They are right that the groups that are dying off are much more likely to vote for traditional conservative Republicanism than the groups that are entering the electorate. They thought that the balance had already tipped and that they didn't have to pay attention to anybody except the new, what they call rising American electorate. You know, Trump proved them wrong. But in about 10 to 12 years, unless the Republicans have reformulated their coalition, if they're still fighting the same wars in 10 to 12 years that they were fighting between 2004 and 2012, they will be the Me Too party because they will always be in second place. The gap is already widening in terms of partisan identification. It will widen further. And then they will be forced into the position they were in the 1940s and 1950s of defining themselves as a very weak sister to a very dominant number one party.
Yeah, that's right. That's the old – that goes back to the old Sam Lubell Future of American Politics where he talked about the sun and the moon party. It's amazing how well that old book holds up, right? And
It's true of most democracies is, you know, I study – that's what I do for UNHERD, U-N-H-E-R-D is, you know, since Americans don't care about what happens in other countries, I got another country to care about what an American thinks about other countries. And every country, pretty much every democracy has a sun party and a moon party. And the question is, who defines the questions that are relevant at the outset of a contentious period? And that group that defines the questions and the answer successfully becomes the Sun Party for so long as those questions remain relevant to the body politic. So you have a Sun Party like Christian Democrats in Germany that have dominated since World War II. And the Democrats were that party before the Gipper. And he basically made it to, you know, kind of like to use a Star Wars analogy, the two setting suns that Luke is looking at as he's departing from the Last Jedi. We basically had a two sun party for 30 country for 30 years, but that's an unnatural situation.
I've thought that explains the what people otherwise call our polarization, right? It's the liberal presumption is that we shouldn't be polarized. You should let us win, right?
Right. Yes. The flip side of that is that the conservative presumption is there's a natural majority who's for us if only we'd be louder and clearer. And that's not true either. It's actually much closer to what Reagan tried to do, which is he called put together a new Republican Party, which is to reformulate questions and answers in a way to make what is not currently a majority into a decisive supermajority. And he almost pulled it off, and I think his successors could have if they had understood him better.
Less said about his successors right now, the better for the moment. Two thoughts on that, by the way. I mean, you mentioned in your book that we'll come to, and I've talked about it a lot, that new Republican Party speech that Reagan gave in February of 1977. You know, I don't think there's a recording of that speech anywhere. I looked high and low. Did you ever find one?
No, I found a lot of written versions, but I've never been able to find a recording. And of course, you know, in a sense, that's understandable, is that the conservative movement in February of 1977 could have been held in a phone booth. You know, I was at a meeting, and after 2012, the State Policy Network meeting, and Grover Norquist, who was at that meeting, I was quoting the speech, and I turned to him and I said, you were there at the fourth CPAC. Is this group larger than fourth CPAC? And he looked at me and said, yeah, it was.
Right. Let me have you talk a minute about one particular issue, since you're talking about who defines the terms of debate, which I think you have written about it, and I just don't remember it. I missed it. But it's immigration, right? It seems to me that the Democrats have done something very clever by framing this around one word, and that's dreamers, right?
Right.
Who can be against dreamers? And they've stigmatized or tried to stigmatize illegal immigrant. Although I didn't, you know, as Michael Barone wrote a day or two ago, no one actually uses the phrase undocumented alien in any ordinary conversation, right?
My understanding is the last undocumented alien was E.T., and that didn't turn out so well.
You know, it always comes back to Star Wars and science fiction. Okay, before this is over, you have to get in at least one Star Trek reference. That's one challenge for you. So,
you've got it.
Anyway, so break down immigration as you see it right now, if you can.
Yeah, immigration is an issue that cannot be defined in terms of race. From a Republican perspective, it needs to be defined in terms of class and community. That when somebody talks about the X coming from overseas, whether it is the Muslims or the Mexicans or the Asians or whoever the X is. That polarizes the debate because it introduces senses of ethno-nationalism, and it creates an us versus them. What countries that successfully reform immigration do is classify it in terms of what we do for all of our citizens. And that unifies rather than divides. And if you do that, now you tend not to have much poll data on that because guess who writes all the poll questions? Hint, hint, it's not the center right. But you know, you take a look at countries that have successfully reformed immigration. That's the grounds upon which they do it. They, you know, say that we want to be compassionate, but we want to create a Australia or New Zealand or Canada that works for everyone, that people are productive and add to society. And they never talk about race or background. You do that, and I think what you do is unite the moderate suburbanites who would like to be open to people of different backgrounds, but also want them to be productive, as well as the people of less affluent means who feel direct competition from people who are here illegally. And you create a majority that does not exist if you talk about it in terms of saving our country or them versus us.
You mentioned Australia and New Zealand. What are some of the other examples of countries that have sort of more sensible immigration? As I understand Australia, they look for skilled immigrants, but also right. take in refugees. So it's sort of what you might say a barbell approach. I don't know.
Most countries take in some refugees. But for Australia, the 2010 election was fought around the question of what they called the boats, that refugees would try and arrive. Because, of course, Australia is an island, so nobody can walk across an undefended border. They have to sail across an undefended border. And the idea was that, you know, if the boats came and land, that the Labor government would give people refugee status. And the conservative coalition, two parties in permanent coalition, argued, no, you know, we need to stop the boats. And that if you got here, we would send you to an offshore processing place where we would assess your claim and return you. And that's, in fact, been the policy of Australia since 2010. And they won an election on the basis of that, that they did something that had not been done in Australian history, which is deny a government a re-election with a majority after only one term. And they did it on the basis of attacking the carbon tax, which right. the Labor had done, and attacking the liberal refugee policy. And guess what? You attack the hard left with sensible, non-racially charged, non-ideological arguments, and you can attract the middle.
You know, it's
And one other thing is they did it with a very large upswing in working class Western Sydney.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. It didn't always win them all the seats they wanted to, because a lot of the working class districts like they are here are highly Labor or, you know, here highly right. Democratic, but it was enough that they picked up seats and deprived Labor of their majority. That combination of working class with traditional upper class has been the basis of the successful coalition policy since Robert Menzies in 1943.
You know, I don't follow those foreign elections the way you do. I had missed that election, but what I realize now from hearing you recount it is that had been building for a long time. You know, I spent 2 months in Australia back in the mid 1980s, and you get up to the Northern Territories. I went everywhere. Very sparsely populated area. But what was on people's minds? Well, they called it, typical Australians, they called it the refugee regatta. Right? I mean, of course they did. Yeah. The boats were coming over from wherever then, and it was very controversial, but you can see it finally caught the attention of other people in the urban areas and whatnot. So
yeah, well, you know, one of the Australia had an outburst of anti-immigrant populism in the mid-1990s, when a woman who has now resurfaced, Pauline Hanson, ran as a then Liberal Party candidate in a working class seat in Queensland named Oxley, unexpectedly won, had to leave the party because of her position and formed a party called One Nation, which was talking about refugee policy. And they did exceedingly well in the 1995 or 96 election. And John Howard, the prime minister, co-opted her, the sensible parts of her policies, cleaved off the racism from the sensible part, and adopted a stricter immigration policy, which then gave him 11 years of dominance at the federal level.
Uh-huh. Let's come back home for a bit. And although I'm tempted to say, maybe we should talk about an immigration policy that says no Klingons or Romulans allowed. There, I beat you to it. Sorry.
Well, that means that we need funding for a neutral zone on the Rio Grande.
Well, could be. You know, the other line I often use is that, you know, I'm a little behind on pop culture, but I didn't realize that this Keeping Up with the Kardashians was a Star Trek spinoff. That's what I thought. Okay, enough misbehavior. The midterm election's coming up.
Well, it ties in with Australia because, you know, Khan's ship was known as the Botany Bay.
Botany Bay. No, that's really good. See, I would that you, there you go again, as our hero would say. You wrote in the City Journal here a few days ago about the prospects for the midterm elections here in November. I don't know if you saw what Jim Garrity wrote about this at National Review in the last few days. He points out that yeah, there have been a lot of Republican retirements in the House, but overwhelmingly they're from strong Republican districts.
And, they are largely, but there are now with Meehan's retirement in suburban. You know, it's amazing how when a 62-year-old man decides that a 28-year-old assistant is his soulmate, and why that causes political problems. But there are 23 Republican seats that they currently hold that Mrs. Clinton won, and six of them have now retired. So yes, it's disproportionately, but on the other hand, 25% of the seats the Democrats need to take over are now open by retirement, with many more potentially to come.
Well, your City Journal article, I think, made the point or rested a lot of it on the fact that the president's approval rating is really strongly correlated with party performance in midterm elections.
Right.
And so right now, of course, things may or will change between now and November. Right now, your expectation is?
My expectation is if nothing changes, if the election were held today and the Democrats succeeded in putting together, you know, as the sort of strong challenges that you would expect as the filing deadlines come, that Democrats would win 25 to 30 seats in the House and take control, that they would pick up 1 to 2 seats in the Senate to counterbalance a gain of 1 or 2 because the map is so favorable to Democrats, and that Republicans would lose the vast majority of purple state open seat governorships.
Yeah. So in other words, a rough year.
General, a very rough year. You know, I have looked back at the past, and generally if a president goes into a midterm with a rating of 40% or below, that's when you see waves or quasi waves, you know, that big losses or disastrous losses, depending on the year.
Yeah. And if it doesn't happen, I have an easy prediction to make, which is the liberals who are screaming about gerrymandering, they've already turned it up to 11, but they'll go absolutely berserk and blame it on gerrymandering, right?
Oh, absolutely. Unless Donald Trump's ratings do somehow manage to get up into 43% and 45%, then it'll be a little hard for them. But, you know, I got my start in the early 1980s, studying gerrymandering.
I remember.
Yes. And I remember when, you know, I'm sitting in a room when Democrats eliminate 5 or 6 House seats in California in 1981, and an effort I helped draw was thrown off the ballot in 1984 by a Democrat-nominated Supreme Court. There were 6 Democrats out of 7, and they voted to throw the initiative that would have overturned the gerrymander off by a 6-to-1 vote. I'm sure it was all about law. And no one talked about gerrymandering back then. It's amazing how now that it's the Republicans who are doing it, that it is the evil and the bane. You know, Massachusetts has been gerrymandered for so long, people forget what Republican representatives can look like.
Oh, no, the hypocrisy on this is absolutely stunning. If I ever get time, I'm going to go back and find all the, you know, the L.A. Times editorials and the court and, you know, the TV ads with Jack Lemmon. You may remember those from the mid 80s saying it'd be terrible if we I mean, I didn't say this directly, but what they essentially said was it would be terrible if we undid gerrymandering and undermined a Democratic Party majority, right? No, it's really quite disgusting, but they're getting away with it to some extent, and I kind of enjoy them saying this is now the greatest threat to democracy since, I don't know.
Well, you know, gerrymandering is a problem. The problem is, are you going to care about it when it's your side that's wielding the knife? And I think we know the answer to the question.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You know, the lamb is always asking for mercy, and the butcher rarely does so.
Yeah. Okay. Last subject. Let's talk about Rinaldus Magnus for a bit, our hero. So, look, you know, I thought I knew pretty much everything about Reagan. And then your book, Working Class Republican, came along. I had the title right. Hold on a second. Working Class Republican. But you noticed some things about Reagan that I had completely missed, even though I'd read a number of the speeches and articles that you brought our attention to. I can think of some examples about this, but I think, first of all, sort of briefly state your thesis, and then I'm going to have to abuse you a bit because that's my job.
That's fine. I mean, me too, as they say. My thesis basically is that you have to square Reagan's conservatism with two things. One, the fact that he was a very, very partisan liberal Democrat for over 20 years in his adult life. And second, that he explains his conversion not by saying, I completely changed my political philosophy, but rather by saying the opposite, that I didn't change my views very much. The Democratic left party left me. I didn't leave the Democratic Party. So assuming that Ronald Reagan is not the best liar this side of the current occupant of the White House, that has to be true. How can it be true? And that's what my book goes through, is trying to explain how it can be true. And the reason how I come out as true is that what Reagan always cared about was the actual life lived by an average American. That did that person have sufficient resources and sufficient opportunity to live a dignified life of their own choosing? And in the when he was a Democrat, he believed the main problem came from an unregulated private sector, because we forget, having lived 85 years after the New Deal, how unregulated American business was in 1927 when Ronald Reagan was 16 years old. But by the 1950s, he came to believe that big government was an even more death threat, and that the middle ground of a properly regulated, properly modulated, non-libertarian but non-socialist state was what Reagan's conservatism was. And that's what I call blue-collar conservatism. And that explains why he's the only president to be able to dramatically change the partisan makeup of the country since Franklin Roosevelt. And he did it by communicating to people who had, before he became president, thought of themselves as working-class Democrats. And by the end of his reign, thought of themselves as Republican. And it's precisely because he was unlike the Republicans who preceded him in the way he talked and what his priorities were.
Well, now in your book, you and some of your articles that have gone along with it, you make the point that Reagan supported a, I won't say vigorous safety net. That vocabulary, I think, is important. We can come back to that. But, you know, he was not categorically opposed to what we otherwise describe as a welfare state. And so I think you even go further, don't you, and suggest that there's a continuity between him and Roosevelt and the New Deal.
Yes, I do. So the question is, what was the New Deal about? And I think for most Republicans, they look at the New Deal and they see either one of two things. They see government power or they see government control of the economy. Ronald Reagan clearly opposed that when he was a Roosevelt backer. But when he became a conservative, that was the focal point of his attack, which is that the Democratic Party had morphed from something that helped the average person to something that was enacting government and state control of our lives through the back door. What he did not oppose was the use of government power to give people genuine opportunity. So he never said the Wagner Act that required unions and employers to bargain with their unions, which was a New Deal thing. He never opposed that. Social Security was a New Deal program that established our first social insurance program so that people would have a government-guaranteed pension. He never opposed that. He always said, even through the presidency, that the problem was that there should have been a means test so that it only went to the people who genuinely needed it rather than something that he personally, as a millionaire, was eligible for. That was Reagan's viewpoint. And that was a continuity with the way Roosevelt talked about the role of the individual and government. And as I show in the book, it was so deep for this man who actually listened to Reagan, to Roosevelt's fireside chats, and had such a good memory he could recall them decades later, that when time and time again, famous Reagan phrases were in fact either direct quotations or paraphrases of what Roosevelt had said on the air 40 years earlier.
Right. No, I've noticed that too. I mean, those radio addresses of Roosevelt are really something, which is why Reagan liked the radio, right? Partly.
Yeah. I mean, well, Reagan was a radio practitioner, and it's kind of like he was learning his art, and his political interest meant that he learned from the master.
The way I put it is Reagan was, which I think is harmonious with mostly with yours, is that Reagan was for social insurance, but against social engineering, which was a great society. He was for a safety net, but against redistribution, which is the other hallmark of modern liberalism, right? Is its obsession with redistributionism. He was for opportunity rather than rigid equality. I think those are all right. There's this stumbling block, though, for you, which I'm not sure. I mean, I know I wrote this in a review and we never did have our proper exchange about that. But there is Reagan saying a couple of times in the 1970s that fascism was really the basis of the New Deal. It doesn't get much harsher than that. So isn't that a bit of a stumbling block to saying that that we should think about Reagan as as something of a New Dealer?
Well, you know, and then you've also got the fact that that Reagan in his diary says the press is trying to portray me as overthrowing the new – trying to repeal the New Deal. I remind them I voted for Roosevelt four times. I'm not trying to repeal the New Deal. I'm trying to repeal the Great Society. So the question is, in the context, what was he talking about? And when Reagan makes those comments, he's talking not about the social insurance. He's talking about the social engineering, the government direction of the economy, the sorts of things that the early parts of the New Deal were trying to do. And as Jonah Goldberg and others have pointed out, that, you know, that's not a historically inaccurate claim, is that much as people in the 1980s looked over at Japan and said, oh, they're eating our lunch, we have to be more state-directed like the Japanese capitalism, there were progressive thinkers who looked over at a pre-World War II Italy that had gone from chaos to some degree of order and who said, hey, you know, we can have the economic corporatism without the political suppression. And that would be what Reagan meant by fascism, not the suppress, although Reagan would argue that if you do the one, you ultimately are in tension with having to do the other, that if you control people's productive lives, you also have to control their intellectual and personal lives.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure Reagan read either Hayek's complete book, The Road to Serfdom, or the Reader's Digest condensation, which was a big sensation in the country when it came out, right?
Reagan, not only that, I've come across – I didn't write about it in the book, but I've come across, you know, Reagan says that he read the classics, Henry Hazlitt's Economic and One Lesson. Frederick Bastiat's The Law was a favorite of his. And in some of his speeches, I have seen how Reagan reformulated very complex thoughts of both of them into very average-sounding words. So it wasn't just that he skimmed it. He understood it and thought, how do I make it make sense to an average person who's not going to read Frederick Bastiat's The Law in his spare time?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorite parts about that fascism, the New Deal business, was when in the fall of 1980, reporters tried to badger him about it, and he didn't back down, and he explained exactly what you just said. The authoritarian control of the economy of Italy and Germany and the Soviet Union. And I remember the Washington Post article, I think I have this in my book, the Washington Post article saying, the Washington Post reached out to several historians of the New Deal who have no idea what Reagan was talking about. They're all a bunch of liberals.
Right.
Fun stuff.
And then the thing is, to me, what the reason I push the point hard is because modern conservatism has at its core a contradiction. It has at its core a devotion to a constitutional order and a sense of individual liberty, which carried to a logical extreme, as Bill Buckley did in the 50s and today's libertarians do, means to call into question almost everything that has been done at the national level since at least 1933 and probably with Charles Kessler and the progressives going back to Wilson in 1913. Ronald Reagan was not that person. Ronald Reagan would not do that. And the question is, does the modern conservative movement, which accommodates itself to the political reality that one can't do it, have a weakness in the political reality in conflict with the intellectual reality that prevents them from making America great again? My argument is yes. And it's by understanding Reagan's understanding of that contradiction and how he overcame it is how you can actually duplicate a success. But you can't get there unless you confront it.
Okay, this can go on a while, but we're yes. just about out of time, and we'll do it again. But okay, so last question, a two-part question. First of all, I don't know how you find time in the middle of following all the polls of this country and others to also keep up your fantasy baseball habit. And so, actually, the question don't actually answer that question. Answer the second question, which is, who's going to win the World Series this year?
Oh gosh, who's going to win the World Series this year?
You get to change your mind later, of course, like you did with the election. But
yeah. One of the reasons I'm hesitating is there are so many high-profile free agents. You know that if Yu Darvish signs with the Yankees, that makes them, I think, a co-equal with the Astros for the American League. But if Darvish doesn't, then I think the Astros are the best team in the American League. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say the Washington Nationals, because they're the best team that has continually choked in the playoffs over the last 5 or 6 years. And I think eventually that talent that they've got, the starting rotation, the hitters, is finally going to click, and a little bit of the luck that's evaded them is going to fall their way.
Okay. Well, I won't hold you that much, but we will sign off quickly. You will appreciate the sign-off phrase that we decided to adopt for the Powerline show, which is, never forget to milk the soft power dividend. I have had a few readers say, what are you talking about? But you know, I'll explain it to people later.
Oh, gosh.
I hope that phrase lives forever, and I'm going to do my best to keep it alive. You know,
God yeah, well, it'll be Samantha. The only thing people remember Samantha Power for long after she never gets into office.
That's anymore. Right. Okay, Henry, you go out today and milk the soft power dividend, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks.
Live long and prosper, Steve.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.